BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
This is one of our new Mentally Interesting podcasts, which we hope you'll come to know and love. Just a note that suicide and previous self-harm do get mentioned in this episode, within conversations about shame, having a baby in a pandemic, and how to tell a new partner about your mental health. We know it's useful for some of you to have prior notice of these subjects, so now that you know, it's over to the brilliant Seaneen and Mark.
This is Mentally Interesting, a podcast series from BBC Ouch. I'm Mark Brown.
And I'm Seaneen Molloy. We're longtime friends. We've got years and years of personal and professional experience of being mentally interesting and living with mental health difficulties. And we're talking about all the awkward stuff so you don't have to.
And my gosh, is there a lot of awkward stuff to talk about. Each episode of Mentally Interesting has a broad theme. This one deals with the massive, painful, gloopy, dark, but ultimately uplifting subject of shame.
If you want to talk about shame or any other awkward topic, ouch@bbc.co.uk is email address to get in touch. And we're also on Twitter and Facebook at BBC Ouch.
So, how are you doing this episode, Seaneen? Listeners who listened to our last episode will know that Seaneen is going through a life change.
Literally, I'm having my second baby in 2 days. And I'm getting my COVID test today, and I have this weird feeling like I'm about to sit an exam and I'm going to fail it. I have no idea where I would have got COVID from, but I have a feeling that I must have it. So I'm a bit nervous. There's kind of nothing more shaming than being a new mum, especially one with a mental illness. Everyone really likes to stick their oar in and tell you how you're doing everything wrong. And so I've got bipolar disorder, which is kind of super risky when you're pregnant. It's one of the trickiest times. And I've been okay. Partly because I've been on a new medication, an antipsychotic, which has really annoyed me by being helpful. I was so angry to be put on it. I'm like, I can control my mind like Yoda, but I apparently I can't. And I've basically not been sleeping for about 3 months. And if I hadn't had that medication, I think I would have gone mental by now. It's not fair. It's not fair that they're right sometimes. I'm a bit nervous about it because over here in Northern Ireland, the changes around Labour haven't come in, so my husband can stay with me for the grand total of 1 hour, hooray, after I have my C-section. And had a bit of a ropey experience last time when I was in the postnatal ward with my son. So I have like self-harm scars all over my arms, and they're really old. Like they would basically be, you know, doing their GCSEs. or not, as it seems, in lockdown now. I was sitting on my bed in the postnatal ward and I had to stay in a few days like I have to this time so they can keep an eye on me to make sure that I'm not, you know, going mental. And a midwife phoned the mental health team because I was sitting on the bed with self-harm scars that were really old. They kind of burst into my room because no one told me that they'd been called. When they came in and I was sitting there kind of placidly reading my magazine and they were like, okay. But Robert, who's my husband, was like absolutely furious. He was just like, we've been disturbed all the time. She's here to try and get some rest for her mental health. And all we're getting is people bursting in. You know, she hasn't done anything wrong. She's just tired. And I'm kind of frightened this time that I haven't got anyone to stand up for me in case that happens again. So I have to try and basically be a new mother who's just had a baby in a pandemic through an operation, being visited by the home treatment team and not show any emotions whatsoever because I'm scared if I do, they're going to judge me. And I think I'm already worried, again, shame, already worried about judgment because of I can't breastfeed on this medication. It's not that it's like super sedating like quetiapine was, but it's it seems to have just done a number on it. And because of my mental health, again, my husband has to do basically the majority of the care to begin with so I can get some sleep. So he hasn't got boobs. So I just use a bottle. I am pretty apprehensive about it, but also, yeah, I'm excited. By our next episode, I will have another baby, which is very weird. I haven't actually had any mental space to think about that yet.
Well, it's quite a busy time, gestating a small human inside of you. It seems to be quite a common experience for a lot of people who are disabled, that experience of people thinking they're looking after you, but doing it without realising sometimes that you're a person with feelings and desires and experiences. And you're not just something to be ticked off and looked after. You're also a person as well. Because I think it's really easy to do things that feel like they're in someone else's best interest while also making them feel terrible and ashamed for you intervening.
That's definitely a thing. It's for your own good is a real big thing when you have a disability. It's just this paternalistic kind of attitude towards you. I mean, if that midwife had come in and spoken to me and said, oh, I'm concerned about you, and I'd be like, okay, why? But then it would have been different. But it was the lack of consent just like literally went over my head. I mean, I think that's just a universal experience with disability generally. Whether you're blind and someone grabs you by the arm and tries to move you around, or whether, you know, you're in a wheelchair and someone pushes you out of the way, you know, just, yeah, it's not good. Don't do that, everyone who's listening who hasn't got any disability experience.
The thing with shame and kind of shaming behaviour is it doesn't tell you that what you've done is wrong. It tells you that you're wrong. I imagine there's still an overhang of, you know, centuries and centuries of the idea that people who experience mental health difficulties shouldn't have children at all. So there's a sense that you are a risk. Not that you're at risk, but somehow you are a risk, which must be awful.
That's definitely true. And I think that was what really hurt in this experience, was because I wasn't doing anything. It was that I was existing. I was sitting there as a new mother with self-harm scars on my arm, and that was enough to be a risk.
So, back to the main topic of this podcast, which is shame. What is shame? It's a sense of having been wrong, of being the wrong thing, the wrong person. It's like shame's something that gets in your bones. When you feel guilty about something, you can apologise. When you feel shameful about something, you sometimes feel like there's no way you can ever make up for it. I'm someone who would describe themselves as kind of dripping with shame. Like, shame is my personal scent. Other people have Dupe and CK1. I have older shame.
You reek of it, Mark. You reek of shame. I can smell it from here.
Yeah, so it's my particular existential musk. And a lot of us who've had kind of experiences in our childhood, in our past, where we've not been in control of the things that happen to us, where things have happened to us around us that have involved us that we've not really been able to do anything about, a lot of us carry that sense of shame that somehow we could have made things turn out differently if we'd been a different person into adulthood. So I kind of get that quite a lot. And it's not a good feeling. It's a really difficult feeling. It's something that goes kind of hand in hand with my own experiences of mental health difficulties sometimes, if I feel like I've not been the best person in the world or done the right things. I'm a little bit like a dog who's got up on the top shelf and eaten all the treats. Like, when I feel like I've been caught, I just kind of turn around, my tail disappears between my legs, and then I just face the wall in my dog bed for a couple of days, feeling absolutely terrible.
Oh, I want to hug little dog Mark.
Yeah, well, it's a massive dog, Mark. I'm 6'3", so it's like, you know, it's like one of those great big lurchers with like matted hair and slobbering jaws. But I think, like with mental health, we often don't talk about shame because it's so, so painful, and shame's so, so tied up with who you are and what's happened to you. And it's my kind of feeling that any of us will do just about anything we can to escape from shame. Mm. And that's sometimes what, you know, for me, certainly in the past, that's put me in dangerous situations or unhappy situations where I've been trying to please people around me in situations where I really shouldn't have been trying to please those people at all. There are people who didn't have my best interests at heart, and it was really, really painful and really, really difficult. So kind of, you know, shame's something that gets under your skin. And with mental health, we often have that kind of feeling. And well, I don't know, maybe you don't have this kind of feeling, Shanine, but it's kind of feeling that somehow we're the wrong person. We're the thing that makes situations go weird. If we could have just got up one morning and no longer been mental, then everything would have went swimmingly and we'd be carrying no sense of having ruined everything and made everything go wrong and awful. I think for about the last decade, certainly in the UK, we've had a massive push towards removing the stigma of mental health. And we've looked at that often as being other people's prejudices around mental health. You know, we've looked at it as being what we need to do is make people aware of mental health difficulty and what it means for people and get them to stop being so judgmental. But I think a part of it has also been wanting to no longer feel ashamed of not being up to snuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a lot of that kind of the stigma work, it has been good for the public, you know, to try and get people to talk more openly about it, but I'm not sure how effective it's been in terms of our own kind of self-stigma and our shame about ourselves. And I think shame is probably one of the biggest things that kind of stops people from recovering. I mean, in my experience, it's just my experience, the shame after an episode is what makes me depressed for the next 9 months of the year. I've done stuff when I haven't been well. And some stuff that I can't think about now, but some stuff that when I think about it makes me laugh. Like one of my old jobs, I was starting to get quite high and I had this brilliant idea that what I was going to do was just cover my computer screen with post-it notes. And then that just carried on and I started covering my face with post-it notes. And then I just ran down the corridor into the director's office and I danced with post-it notes on my face, thinking that this was hilariously funny and very, very charming and that everyone would think I was fantastic for this. On what planet was I on to think that that was a good idea?
I would have been charmed because I love post-it notes.
That was something I can look back on and think that was quite funny. But obviously I did lose my job, as you would expect. So it had consequences. And it's those consequences are things I find the hardest to deal with when I've been ill. It's like when you've been out drinking and you have a blackout and you check your phone and go, oh my God. And what's worse, having no messages or having 100? It's like the worst beer fear in the universe, and it lasts for like 7 or 8 months. And it's also that you don't remember some parts of it. At least in my case, my memory can be quite patchy if I've been unwell. And you want to find that kind of trusted person to message you and be like, what did I do? Tell me what I did. But you're so terrified of the answer that you can't. So you just go into yourself a bit.
For me, one of the things that feels very, very, very shameful, and it shouldn't, because I should have more compassion for myself, is the fluctuating nature of my own mental health as a chronic condition. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of our listeners will have similar experiences around their own experiences of disability, where something you could do last week and you were a shining golden god doing it, the next week you can't even face.
Yeah.
What you can do is you can send 1 million emails in half an hour and get 30% of the entire world's population to do something. And then the next week, you can't even manage to change your underwear for 3 days. You're trying to explain to someone, well, you know, this is what happens. Things change over time. Unfortunately, I can't promise you the consistency I would like. And you know, I feel like that, for me, a kind of, like, you know, like a certain... certain world government kind of over-promising and over-delivering, even emotionally and personal relationships, has been such a tough thing for me, like not being able to be consistent for other people. That feels, you know, very, very shameful and difficult and challenging. But I think with shame is such a difficult thing to sit with. And it's so close to the surface for those of us who've kind of experienced traumas in the past as well. Because it's almost part of your fight or flight response, your animal response to problems and challenges. It locks me down and it makes me unable to move forward with things. It's really difficult and tough. And I see people in public life and in private life accidentally very often giving shame to another person when there was another way forwards, which was to say, whatever has just happened or whatever situation is or whatever you've been doing and stuff is done, here's how you could make reparations, here's how you could make things different going forwards, let's keep moving forwards. How does it feel for you when you feel a bit shameful?
See, I'm married to someone who has no shame.
Like I have met your husband and yeah. I would agree with that.
Yeah, he has no shame. Honestly, that's been one of the most kind of useful experiences I've had. Sorry, Robert, to call you a useful experience.
He's a lovely useful experience.
A lovely useful experience. But he has no shame. And the antidote to the shame is to be shameless. It's to have no shame, to be armoured against it. And I remember when we got together, like, my CPN, which means, for people who don't know mental health terms, community psychiatric nurse, were just like, he's really good for you because he wears you out and can take everything I do on the chin. And it's actually been very helpful to be in a relationship with someone like that who has no shame, because it's helped me cope with my own shame. Because he's someone as well who appreciates people behaving in unusual ways. And even some of the things I've done when I haven't been very well has amused him greatly. Whereas it's kind of helped me to see it in a different perspective. That the bad thing about some of my behaviour when I haven't been well has been the consequences, but the emotional consequences are easier for me to cope with because I sort of use his perspective. But also there's this, and you were talking about self-compassion earlier. You know I don't like these kind of terms, but I'm going to use it anyway. But it's a genuine, useful concept, self-compassion, which is talk to yourself like you are your own friend. And I have found that really helpful. If someone who you cared about and loved behaved in a way that was shameful, I'm doing air commas here, what would you say? Would you say, okay, so now you deserve to be cast out of public life forever, into the fires of hell, ostracised, everything? Or would you say that everyone in the entire world has behaved in a shameful way? Maybe the way you've behaved has been a bit different, but it is not the end of the world, and you can get past it, and it doesn't mean that you're a bad person. That's the way you would speak to someone that you cared about, and I think trying to exercise that similar compassion to yourself is one of the ways to move beyond it. It's just, what would a friend say to you? Or what would you say to someone if they were your friend?
I know what I do say to friends, and it involves imagining a Victorian machine, a bit like a spinning wheel mixed with an exercise bike, right? So you pedal the wheels, the back wheel turns, but there's just a load of shoes studded around this wheel at the back. And I would call that the bum kicking machine, being aware of not swearing on this podcast. I would say what you need to do is you need to get off the bum kicking machine. You are literally pedaling really hard to escape from your own machine that kicks you up the bum with the things you've done. You don't need to kick yourself twice for things that have happened. Like, if those things are hard, they're hard.
Yeah.
You don't need to perform in your own head the job of making them even harder for yourself. And I say that to other people, and I explain the bum kicking machine, and I've got diagrams and, you know, show where the belt goes and the pulleys and stuff. But when it comes to myself, I just kind of go, well, you would say that, wouldn't you, if you're trying to let yourself off the hook? And it's horrible, and getting stuck in that loop.
Yeah, you just end up with a sore bum, that's all.
Which isn't what you want. So I think about this a lot, what it would feel like to live beyond shame. And I always feel that you're a little bit more confident and a bit more comfortable talking about some of the things that are very core to your experience of who you are and where you've been. Do you think that is part of moving beyond feeling shameful?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's no way a few years ago I would have been able to talk this way about things, especially in my early 20s and stuff. I was basically like a ball of shame. It was my core personality trait, basically. I think it's why as well when I was younger that my experiences of, I still have mental illness and I still experience episodes, but the episodes of depression especially were ferocious. They were episodes of depression that led me into basically, you know, the end. And it was the shame that powered them. And I think as I've gotten older and began to deal with my feelings of shame a bit more, my episodes of depression have kind of lessened a little bit. Not the frequency, but the ferocity. The sheer being sent to hell aspect of them has decreased a little bit. It's hard to know whether that's just because I've started to frame it in a different way or because the consequences are less, because my world's a bit smaller these days. But I'm glad.
So am I.
Yeah. It's good not to feel suicidally depressed all the time.
It's rubbish being younger.
Yeah. It is. I maintain it, right? So you need to get into your 30s, enjoy. Everyone who's listening who's in your 20s thinking things are terrible. Maybe your early 30s, things are also a bit terrible, but then they do get better.
The same things happen, but maybe they hurt less or you kick your own bum less. And now it's time for the book of awkward questions.
In my hands is a mysterious book. It's so heavy I can hardly hold it. thick and leather-bound, corners tipped with brass. It smells of dust and secret places. On its deep red cover, in faded gold leaf, is the title, The Big Book of Awkward Questions. Handed down from generation to generation, only two copies of The Big Book of Awkward Questions are known to be in existence. I have one copy, and Mark has the other. No one knows who compiled it or why, but in it are contained every single awkward question that has ever been asked about mental health. Each of his pages are covered in lines of tiny type so small you have to squint to read it, and smudged with fingerprints. Each week, we'll open a book and see what awkward question it suggests to us. What's the awkward question today, Mark?
Well, I can feel the weight of this book and all of its terrible, terrible probing questions in my hands. So I'm opening it now. I'm running my finger down the lines of type. And today's question is, in a new relationship, how do you tell someone that you're absolutely mental? Is this a problem you've had, Shaneen?
I've always gone with the show don't tell kind of thing. it's something I've had to think about in the past. It's also something that I have genuinely been asked by people. You know, the baby mentals, the little ones who've just got their badge. It's tricky, isn't it? Because, I mean, when? I think that's the big thing, is when do you tell them? You don't want to start off having a beer and be like, hey, by the way. And I think someone's reaction to that says an awful lot as well. I mean, my kind of feeling about this is, when you're describing experiences of mental illness, it's more about how do those things affect you, and talking about if you're experiencing something and just explaining that to someone. For example, the person has actually asked me this question in real life, has got PTSD, and she experienced a flashback when she was with her new partner, and he was kind of scared. Her flashbacks involve sort of zoning out a bit, you know, a bit of kind of dissociation, yeah, which means zoning out and getting a bit panicky. And he was kind of like, oh God, what's wrong? You know, what's happened? And that for her was the way to begin to talk about how she had experiences and how she sometimes would have flashbacks and what those looked like for her and how he could help or not, you know, which for her, she just kind of wanted to be left alone for a few minutes. And that seemed to work in that relationship. It wasn't like a scary diagnostic term. It was just something that happened to her, something she experienced, and something that he could help with.
Mm-hmm. It sometimes feels like handing over the logbook of a car when you've just sold it. except I am the car.
Service history.
Like, it's okay, I've had my MOT, my big end's not knocking. It feels like sometimes it's a bit of due diligence. But I think the question of how do you tell someone is kind of inherently linked to that sense of shame we were talking about earlier in the podcast. Because it's a little bit like coming out. It's a little bit like saying to someone, this is kind of fundamental to me. It doesn't define me, but it is a big part of me.
Yeah.
And if that's going to be a problem for us, then this probably isn't going to work. Because people always think that their romantic partners won't know what's going on inside their head and won't know that they experience mental health difficulty. They will know. It's just about whether they're the right kind of person to be with when they know that.
Yeah.
So I think in terms of broaching the subject, I remember I wrote a piece talking about my own experiences of hypomania. So I have a diagnosis of bipolar 2, the bipolar strikes back. which is a different condition from bipolar 1 and hypomania.
If anyone who doesn't know what we're on about, there's a couple of different types of bipolar. I'm bipolar 1, the original bipolar, and Mark is bipolar 2, bipolar the sequel.
Yeah.
So bipolar 1, people have episodes of mania, so that is when you have loads of energy, you might be quite irritable, very. It's generally like a more extreme version of the high side of bipolar disorder, and it can lead to psychosis. And bipolar 2, I will let Mark explain.
Bipolar 2 is weird because it's mainly depression with something called hypomania that happens every so often. And hypomania is like the foothills of mania. So you feel, you know, I feel full of energy, full of ideas. You know, I'm the world's best talker. Unfortunately, we'll think I'm the world's best dancer, which I'm not. Almost like the mirror of depression, but not necessarily losing touch as much with reality, just thinking you're much better than reality and you will win at everything. So it causes similar challenges and problems. I wrote this piece explaining what it's like to experience hypermania and to overestimate your own ability to deliver on things, but sometimes to be better at things that you would than you would otherwise be. I was absolutely fine about it being published. I was absolutely worried about showing it to my partner because I was like, this is really revealing for me. But then I was like, I've just put, you know, it's just, you know, it's gone up on a big website. People are going to have read that anyway. Why is it harder to say to someone close to me that this is what my life's like sometimes than it is to speak to a whole range of people I will never meet and who I don't drink cups of tea with in bed? Like, why should that be easier?
That's really weird, because as you were saying that, I was thinking I'm exactly the same. Like, I've written a lot about some, you know, fairly talking about shameful experiences, but also, you know, difficult feelings or things I've done or just general mentalness. And I actually feel really uncomfortable with Robert reading it. And even though he, like, you know, lives with me and stuff, I don't know why either. I think because when you're writing something so public for a different audience, which is for everyone, you have to an extent, sort of reduce yourself slightly to an experience or symptoms. And that's what I don't want. And I think that's often the fear in a relationship when you're telling someone or when you're coming out. And it is, that's exactly the right word to use, coming out, is that you're frightened that they're just going to see you as a list of symptoms on a checklist and not a person anymore.
And go back retrospectively and go, you didn't phone me until half an hour after you said you were going to phone me. Is that a symptom of depression? Were you depressed then? Going back to the awkward question, when you're out, you know, on the old dating scene, if you're out on Tinder or Grindr or whatever new iteration of that there is during lockdown, I don't know, emailer, letter writer, you don't necessarily
Zoomer.
You don't necessarily want to share everything about yourself as a way of getting it all out in the open to start with people who maybe don't necessarily have your best interests at heart. That's the thing.
Keeping yourself safe is very important.
So what's the conclusion? Tell people when you feel ready. Tell people when you feel it's safe. Don't be ashamed of telling people. But like with coming out, not everyone gets to have a wonderful coming out experience, and sometimes things don't work out.
And if that's the case, no loss, because that person wasn't right for you anyway. And closing the book of awkward questions.
Thank God for that. Just a quick note on terminology. We've said mental quite a lot in this podcast because we're quite comfortable with each other. You know, we've been in each other's houses. We've met each other's fears and horrors. But mental, what does it mean? And why aren't we wrong for saying it?
Why our producer is banging the glass, as it were, to tell us that we've said it about 50,000 times. Well, it's kind of, you know, mental health language. A lot of people use different terms, and it's hard to find one that you're comfortable with. Some people would say mental illness. Some people say mental health difficulties. Some people say mental health problems. I struggle myself to find the word that I feel comfortable saying. So I say mental. I feel like it's that kind of reclaiming language, because it has been historically used as not a very nice term towards people who are living with mental illness or difficulties or conditions. So personally, the reason I use that word an awful lot is because it is a sort of reclamation. You can't hurt me with calling me mental because I use it myself, basically.
Yeah, and I think as well, it's difficult sometimes for us, because you and I, we kind of live in this world of mental health, and using something like mental in conversation is kind of, a summary of all those experiences and thoughts and ideas as well. You know, talking about being mental is, I think, for us, a way of just going, yep, that's what it's like to live with this stuff. Not to be diagnosed mm-hmm. with this stuff, not to describe this stuff, but to actually live with this stuff. So we apologise if it doesn't quite fit with how you would use it, but we're doing our best here. And I, for one, am actually not ashamed of using the word mental. And with those grand and awkward thoughts, another episode of Mentally Interesting has come to an end. Thank you all for listening to us talk about shame, and thank you for letting us splurge all of our insights all over your ears.
If you fancy sharing your thoughts on this or anything else, email arch@bbc.co.uk, put in mentally interesting or mental in the subject line, or drop us a line on Facebook or Twitter by searching for BBC Arch.
And we'll be back with you next month. And I'm looking forward to meeting your new family member by the next podcast.
Yep. I'll see you next month, everybody. Bye.
Cheers. Bye.